And good morning. Good morning. It's 5 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to Positively Revolting on your very own community radio station. That is KBOO in Portland. I'm Ani, and I'm here with my co-host, Lynn.
Good morning, Ani.
Good morning, Lynn. This morning, we have a special show. On the phone with us, we have Steve Hendricks, who has just written A Kidnapping in Milan, the CIA on Trial. Good morning, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Let's just sort of jump straight into this book, which is the story of a very important incident that hit the headlines a few years back, and a lot of people don't actually even remember it. So let's go ahead and tell that story first off. Your book centers around an Egyptian national who sought residency and asylum in Italy after run-ins with state security elsewhere, a few other states, named Abu Omar. In 2003, he was the victim of a CIA extraordinary rendition. Can you tell our listeners who this man is and how he came to attract the attention of international security forces?
Certainly. Abu Omar was a radical Islamist in Egypt. He lived in Alexandria, Egypt, where he preached a rather stern form of Islam. When he was young, he was picked up and roughed up, even tortured a bit by the Egyptian security services there, who didn't like his preachings against the government. And after this experience of being imprisoned for 6 months, he fled Egypt. And after that, he went on what might be called sort of the jihadist itinerary. It wasn't certain at this point that he was leaning toward terrorism, but he went around for several years, lived in places like Yemen, Peshawar, the Balkans, when the Bosnian War was heating up there, and eventually found his way to Milan, Italy, in about 1997-98 or so. And when he got there, he almost immediately was established as one of the ringleaders of a cell of terrorists who were working out of a radical mosque there in Milan. Milan being one of the most potent seats of radical Islam in Italy. So he had been on the radar screen even before coming to Italy of the CIA and other security services for a while. Now, it happens that the counter-terror police of Milan are among the most competent and most successful in the world. So they already had this mosque where he was, where he set himself up, under pretty tight surveillance. And so almost instantly from his coming there, they had, you know, their eyes on him and knew that he was a danger. Now, he was not a great danger. He was a cog in a machine. There were, you know, scores of men like him throughout Europe who were trying to recruit younger, disenchanted extremist Muslims to become terrorists. Some of these recruiters were successful. Some were more kind of wannabes. So Abu Omar was in this sort of mid-level manager camp.
And as far as the ability, the apparatus on the scene in Milan with the local operatives, local various security forces, from sort of the state security forces to the surveillance and more secret police, the CIA works to develop very intricate relationships with the local scene, as it were. Can you talk a little bit about that and the relationships formed in the various departments to actually accomplish this extradition?
Sure, you're exactly right. Italy has a really overlapping and at times confusing web of intelligence services. It dates back to the time of Mussolini when he didn't trust his police forces, so he set up, you know, sort of rivaling, countervailing forces so that none of them would become too strong. So there is in Italy a sort of CIA-like group called SISMI that does many things like the CIA does, working abroad, but also overseeing domestic terrorists at home. However, down on the ground, most of the counter-terror work in many of the cities, particularly in Milan, is done by a group called DIGOS. And DIGOS might be thought of as somewhere between an American corollary, between a big city major crime squad and the FBI, with a kind of more national reach. The counter-terror police in Milan worked hand in glove with the CIA. Day in, day out, they built cases against all kinds of terrorists there, who they later arrested, prosecuted, convicted, in large part through the collaboration and help of the CIA. And in fact, they had been working with the CIA on building their case against Abu Omar. And they were getting great information out of Abu Omar's cell, in part thanks to technology, bugs and so on, that the CIA had given Degos to monitor Abu Omar with. And they were, so they were milking this information. They were a month, maybe two, away from arresting Abu Omar when they thought they would have gotten everything out of their surveillance of him. And then when the CIA came in and just swooped in, swiped Abu Omar out from under their noses, and without telling them, it was a complete surprise to Degos when they finally, a couple of years later, learned that the CIA had done it. It was just devastating to the Italian-American relationship, and it was a classic case of how our war on terror was supposed to make us safe from terrorists, but actually hindered, made us less safe from terrorists because of breaking up both the Italian surveillance and doing damage to the Italian-American sharing of information.
You're listening to KBOO, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn, my co-host. And on the phone with us this morning, we have Steve Hendricks, the author of Kidnapping in Milan, the CIA on Trial.
This is a call-in show.
Indeed it is, Lynn.
So if anyone would like to do that and have any questions for Steve,
that number to call is 503-231-8187. That's right, 503-231-8187. And let's just go ahead and continue that storyline. So the Italian forces were getting ready to arrest Abu Omar, but as it turns out, the CIA kind of jumped the queue and ordered the events that then took place that resulted in the kidnapping. Can we go ahead and talk about that?
Sure. One fine February day in 2003, Abu Omar sets off for his mosque for the noon prayers. It's a five-minute walk from his apartment, and just disappears, vanishes, not a clue or hint as to where he had gone or why. And so Degos, the counterterror police in Milan, go to their friends at the CIA and ask any idea what might have happened to him. The CIA says, no clue whatsoever. Later they say, we got a tip that he might have gone back to the Balkans where he used to live, so we think that he's probably there. Well, it will surprise no one to know that the CIA was lying. They had snatched Abu Omar and had done so in broad daylight, very brazen fashion, just a block down from one of the busiest streets in Milan, which is Italy's second largest city. If they had grabbed a guy at the lunch hour in Chicago, a block off the Miracle Mile, it just could not have been a more brazen snatch. They right. roughed him up, drove him several hours across northern Italy to Aviano Air Base, flew him from there to Ramstein Air Base in Germany, and forwarded him on to Egypt, where for months and months and months he was savagely tortured. And then the big mystery that arose from that was, why in the world would the CIA want to do this? Why would they want to go in and botch the Italians' investigation? And that was something that I spent a large part of the book trying to find out.
Well, and that is really the ringing question, isn't it? I mean, the CIA, we have we could explore several myths about, law and order, the CIA, the American way, and democracy. We know since the writings of Philip Agee, the CIA is often involved with very unsavory things involving torture and the things that up until the last administration we didn't speak about in this country. What is going on with that? What was the idea behind the CIA behaving in this way?
And, off the record, the CIA will say that what they were trying to do was to extract more information out of Abu Omar than could have been gotten from the taps and so on that the Italians were carrying out, and maybe even that they were hoping to turn him into an informer, to be the big inside man of terrorism in Europe. This was only 18 months after 9/11, and they hadn't had much success in penetrating most terrorist cells. Well, there may be a slight truth to that. However, it's almost certain that that's just bogus. That's a cover. Part of the reason we know that is when you are trying to do those sorts of things, to get valid intelligence out of someone, turn them, and so on, you don't hand them over to another country, least of all the places like Egypt, which are just going to torture the heck out of these people. And, you know, when you do that, you don't know whether you're getting valuable intelligence out of them. You don't know if they're telling you, you know, whatever they're going to try to tell you to try to get you to stop the torture. They're going to say anything they possibly can to try to get you to stop. So it's a terrible way of getting intelligence out of people, and the CIA knows this.
Yet why do they continue to do it, do you think?
Well, there are many reasons. And the general reason is different from the specific reason in the Abu Omar case. The general reason they do extraordinary renditions is because it's quick and easy. It's painless. You pick up a guy,
well, for them,
get him off the street. Well, exactly. You pick up a guy, you get him off the streets, you just dump him in a third world hellhole, and you're done with it. You walk away. The policy of extraordinary rendition actually started under President Clinton, who performed dozens, probably scores of these. And the reason his national security staff thought up extraordinary renditions was because they didn't want to hassle with ordinary renditions, which is to go get a guy in some lawless country where you can't extradite him, say Lebanon during its civil war in the 1980s and early 90s, and bring him back to the U.S., put him on trial, and hopefully convict him. Well, of course, there's a chance you're not going to convict him. And then there's the whole problem of gathering all the evidence you need to convict someone in trial. So rather than upholding these fundamental principles of ours about fair, you know, trials and due process before the law and so on, they just decided they would go snatching these people who they thought were terrorists, but couldn't be certain of course, and dump them off. So that's why they continue to do it.
You have,
cheap and easy.
You have a passage, actually, that's really illustrative of that in your book. Your book, of course, is The Kidnapping in Milan, the CIA on Trial, recently put out by Norton Press. And it was between Clinton and then Vice President Gore.
Yeah, it's a passage that's recounted, actually, in a book by one of Clinton's national security advisors. And it's when they're discussing one of the very earliest renditions. You know, it's in the Oval Office, Clinton is getting some feedback from people in his administration. His White House counsel is listing all the reasons why this is illegal, a terrible idea. It is, in fact, a violation of the UN Convention Against Torture, which Clinton signed and made into law, to export someone to a country where you're almost certain they're going to be tortured. Al Gore had been in South Africa. He flew in late, came into the meeting late, sat down and said, you know, listened to it for a bit and said, oh, well, you know, you're talking about a guy who's a terrorist here. It's a no-brainer. Go grab his ass and throw him off to whatever country you're going to throw him off. And according to this national security advisor, that simple, quick argument settled it for Clinton, and that's, in fact, what he ordered done.
I can't say it stuns me, but it disheartens me on at least a couple of levels. Anyways, I'll move quickly past that. 503-231-8187, the number to call if you'd like to join this conversation with Steve Hendricks on phone this morning, and it's about 20 minutes past 8 o'clock right now. Steve, let's look at the use of torture and how it's used to break a person. That torture is considered unthinkable and barbaric has been, I think, what many people regard as a hallmark of modern democratic society. And while the last U.S. administration, as I alluded to earlier, openly suggested that the threat of international terrorism can justify the use of torture, you write that the CIA had extradited about 70 men before 9/11, as you were talking about, really beginning with the Clinton administration. And Egypt receiving the largest number of people to be interrogated, and what was commonly understood and accepted by the security forces that meant to be tortured. You quote Robert Baer, a CIA officer in the Middle East, as saying, if you want a serious interrogation, you send a prisoner to Jordan. If you want them to be tortured, you send them to Syria. If you want someone to disappear and never to be seen again, you send them to Egypt. So can you talk about that schism between the ideal and the reality of providing national security at the cost of human rights and the rule of law?
Yeah, and it's even questionable whether you're providing national security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that the prosecutor in Milan frequently said, it's been said by other commentators, he's a courageous, charismatic man by the name of Armando Spataro, who eventually took the CIA's kidnappers to trial. And one of the things that he said is, in his Italian way, when we break our most fundamental principles, we give to these fish other water to swim in. And he's absolutely right. When we go out and show that we're not the shining democracy that we are, we give the terrorists extra firepower. They recruit more terrorists that way. It's exactly the case with the war in Iraq, right? We go in there on the false pretense of stopping Al-Qaeda, which wasn't there, and we give all sorts of ammunition to terrorist recruiters who then create more terrorists. We have created more terrorists. And the torture is a huge part of that. In Egypt, one of the big reasons that there are so many continues to be so many fundamentalist and then, of course, fundamentalist terrorist folks who come out of Egypt, who are fomented in there, one of the reasons is because that's where the Muslim Brotherhood was founded at the beginning of the 20th century. But a big reason why it continues is because Egypt was such an early and thorough and brutal use of imprisonment and torture.
With the Muslim Brotherhood in particular, as I recall.
Absolutely. You know, they rounded up in order to squash the Muslim Brotherhood. This was back at the time when the Brotherhood espoused terrorism. It has since renounced it. But in order to crush it, they picked up thousands of these guys. They picked up so many people who were just even remotely associated with the Brotherhood that they had to build new prisons to hold them all. And almost every single one of these guys was tortured. At a minimum, they were brutalized and held in terrible conditions. You had people who went into these prisons who, you know, were fundamentalist in their beliefs, but they didn't espouse violence. They didn't agree with terrorism. Well, believe me, when they came out of that experience, you know, 5-10 years later, however long it was before they were released, many of them were ready to take up the sword, as it were, against the government, and not just the Egyptian government, but the many governments who supported them, chief among them, the U.S. government. So, you know, again, another example of how brutalizing people, torturing them, is not going to make us any safer. It's going to forge the stronger maul that then they're going to take up in their hands and wield against us.
I think that point cannot be emphasized enough. Torturing and the sacrificing of human rights does not bring security to anyone ever.
It really doesn't. You know, in the short term, it can. In the short term, Egypt wiped out, you know, terrorism in its borders. But in the long term, it just doesn't. And again, you know, to reiterate, it doesn't get you good intelligence either. There's absolutely no way of knowing whether they're just telling you something to get you to stop. And I will also say again, the CIA knows this.
I was going to say, it's hard to believe any person would really think that you could actually get it. I don't know anyone who doesn't think that's just a cheap excuse.
Well, it's definitely tempting to think it, and there certainly are people who do believe it, who believe it sincerely. You know, in the circles that I run in, probably that you do too, people see through it, but that's not the case in the right wing. But, you know, more importantly, you have folks within the CIA, within military intelligence, who have been looking at how to interrogate people for years. Torture is the cheap, easy way that makes you think you're getting something. But even as far back as, say, World War II, there was a classic interrogation manual that was written by a Marine Corps officer who was an interrogator in the Pacific campaign against the Japanese. Now, the Japanese at that time were seen about the way that extremist Muslim terrorists are viewed today, as subhuman, as impossible to reason with, as people who are so deranged, there's no way to get anything out of them, and so then you've got to torture them. Well, this guy, Sherwood Moran, this Marine, he went in and spoke to these Japanese captives who had been captured in battle. He spoke to them as humans. He spoke to them gently. He, you know, made them comfortable, gave them cigarettes. He didn't bend and cave into them or anything, but he made clear that he respected their humanity. And within, you know, 24 to 48 hours, he was getting complete battle of operation plans out of these guys. Information, intelligence that saved, no doubt, thousands of GIs' lives on those invasions of the Pacific Islands. This isn't something that was discovered yesterday. This is something that's been known for 50, 60 years, and after dabbling in torture in the meantime, and knowing that they don't get anything out of it, it's a miracle. It's not a miracle, but it is a wonder that it survives.
We have Thomas joining us with us on the phone as well. Good morning, Thomas.
Yes, good morning. It's wonderful to hear Mr. Hendricks sharing his insights this morning, and it's very provocative. And I just have a sort of a question, comment having to do with, you know, this history of the CIA. Clearly, you know, if one really goes and looks in one's local library, you know, there's a whole series of individuals who have been highly placed CIA professionals who have essentially turned into dissidents. Whether it's, you know, presently the likes of Ray McGovern or Ralph McGeehee and the late Philip Agee and also John Stockwell, and the list goes on. And almost to a person, what we see is essentially a story of an agency that's involved directly in murder with murderers, drug traffickers, torturers, authoritarian dictators, subverting democracy. And we're not talking about exceptions. We're talking about the rule.
Right.
And my question is this, is that we see this going across Democrat and Republican administrations alike. You know, in moments of rare candor, you get statements such as Lyndon Johnson, President Lyndon Johnson, saying, well, we were running a damn murder incorporated in Latin America. But, you know, going to today, you know, and going through Democrat administrations today, we, you know, of course, you mentioned the Anti-Terrorism Act of 1996, which effectively began the practice of extraordinary rendition. And then going forward, we see the CIA involvement in the attempted coup in Venezuela and Haiti. And also,
don't forget Chile.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and more recently, and just in Honduras, and indeed the late WikiLeaks beginning to show that indeed the United States government, while it was telling us that they were uncertain about the legal standing of the situation, that the cables were from the State Department were showing that they were in agreement that it was an illegal coup in Honduras. So, going to this point, can we really expect that with this degree of complicity and in intelligence committees during the Bush administration, now it's clear that these torture and rendition was essentially signed off on or given approval, if not direct official but tacit approval, by Democrats and Republicans in these intelligence committees behind closed door. Can we really expect any type of justice from either one of these or any type of legal action from Eric Holders or any other conceivable attorney general when there's this degree of complicity? Or are we going to have to rely on the international, on pressure from international entities and bodies in other countries for any sense of justice or redress of some of these egregious and terrible violations of human rights?
Thank you very much for your question, Thomas.
Thank you.
A good question, and so much meaty stuff to comment on there. The short answer to are we going to get anything out of our current administration in the way of justice is no. You know, sadly, that's the case. It's just so tempting for presidents when they get in there, presidents who don't have a strong moral opposition to the things we're talking about, to say, yeah, this is a nice, easy set of tools in the toolbox to use, rendition and torture and so on. And Obama has continued to use it, and that's why we're not going to get any war crimes prosecutions and so on from him. It's a big reason, not the only one. Now, when I say he's continued to use it, most everyone knows that he took this dramatic step of banning torture by U.S. personnel. He also, at the same time, much more quietly, said we are going to continue to have available to us extraordinary renditions. So we're not going to torture, but torture by proxy is fine. Now, if, as is highly likely, Obama has availed himself of this tools. He has gone off and sent people to torture. You can understand why he's not pushing for prosecution of the Bush war crimes, because it would open himself up to it. It would also, as I said, because it was Clinton who started the program and did perhaps 50 of these renditions, it would open Clinton to prosecution as well. So that's a huge part of the reason, not often discussed by the media, as to why he's not pushing this, as opposed to just this, I want to unite and divide and look forward and not look back and so on.
Well, and that kind of brings me to pondering that you note that the behavior actually, looking at a little more history, Reagan, going back to Reagan in 1986, signed a National Security Decision Directive. And you talk about that as sort of being an, I don't want to say, it's more of another cog, not really a founding document, as you noted that the practice itself actually had precedent stemming back 100 years earlier in 1883. But that up until the last 25 years, it wasn't really thinkable that extraordinary renditions were going to take place in the developed nations, that up until the more modern times, snatching suspects from the streets was pretty much relegated to developing nations. The term Mexican extradition, what became sort of used. Can you talk about that shift?
Yeah, absolutely. It began, as you say, the U.S. policy of renditions began back in 1883 when a larcenist from Chicago fled to Peru. And we went down and snatched him. Peru was then in a state of war, and brought him back to the U.S., and the Supreme Court, after much litigation, said that was okay. Renditions appear to have been used sparingly since then, and in all cases up through the 80s, the people who were brought back were brought to trial. They had their hour or day or month or whatever it was in court to argue their innocence. Wasn't the best circumstance from which to argue it, but they did have their chance, and there were some people who argued successfully and got off. And yes, exactly, these were known as Mexican extraditions because almost all of them took place south of the border. And they continue, for the most part, to be that way. There was some talk in the 1990s by the U.S. Marshals of going and fetching Mark Rich, the billionaire junk bond trader who fled the country after being indicted and was eventually, in the last sorry hours of the Clinton administration, pardoned by Clinton. He fled to Switzerland. The marshals had rattled their swords a bit about going over and getting him, and the Swiss made clear in no uncertain terms that anyone who tried a kidnapping on their soil would be arrested and prosecuted for it. And we've backed off. That was one of the startling things about the kidnapping in Milan. This wasn't someone that was grabbed in Pakistan. It wasn't someone who was grabbed in Africa. It wasn't someone grabbed in Afghanistan. He was grabbed in Italy. And that was what made, unfortunately, the huge fallout. We don't care if people are grabbed elsewhere. The American people at large haven't cared. But they cared about this one, and it wasn't the only one that the CIA was contemplating. They were contemplating several in Norway and other such places in Northern Europe that didn't come off, although they did arrest one person, whisk him off to Egypt in a sort of pseudo-rendition that was with the help of Scandinavian police authorities. But in general, it hasn't been tolerated, and the fallout that has come from this in Western Europe, from the fiasco in Milan, strongly suggests that this isn't going to happen again in Western Europe. Again, though, the rest of the world, probably fair game still.
And is that really what made this case different, the fact that it was in a modern Italian city, a highly densely populated, very sophisticated first world nation?
Yes, absolutely. But not only that. It's that it was an ally of ours. Mm. And someone, again, who, the CIA's own criteria, stated internally criteria for extraordinary rendition, is it's to get the worst of the worst off the streets when there's no other way to get them. Well, Abu Omar, as I've said, wasn't the worst of the worst. He was a cog And there wasn't, it wasn't the case that there was no other way of getting him. The Italians had him under great surveillance, you know, tightly bugged and followed and so on, and would have known if he was going to cause any damage, and they were going to, as I say, arrest him. And eventually, after he was rendered, the Italians did arrest pretty much his whole cell, convicted the lot of them. Every single one of them went to prison.
Can we, let's look at the case. The officers were tried in absentia. Can you talk about the practice of the case? How did this case actually get conducted?
Sure. Armando Spataro, this magistrate, which in Italy a magistrate combines the role of what we in America think of as a prosecutor and the chief investigator of the police, he gathered a ton of evidence. And the evidence that he gathered was a trail of clues, amazingly sloppy clues, that the CIA kidnappers left strewn around Milan. They used their cell phones like teenagers, calling each other back and forth. And each call, leaves a trace in the cell phone company's records. And so he was able, since he knew that Abu Omar had disappeared on his way to his mosque at a pretty specific hour, he went and got the records for all those cell companies, cell towers in that area, to look if there was anything suspicious. And what he found was this sort of increasing crescendo of calls that peaked at the time that Abu Omar was kidnapped, between a dozen or more people who, you know, from, because it's a dense city and the cell towers are pretty close together and all, who he could tell were scattered right along the route of where Abu Omar walked. And, you know, clearly they were calling back and forth and saying, hey, do you see him yet? Yeah, he's coming down the street. He's heading for the van. Okay, we grabbed him, we got him, so on. By getting those, identifying those cell phone numbers, he traced them back through their history, was able to find other people that they had called within the proceeding anywhere from a few weeks to a few months, depending on how long the various kidnappers from the team were there and planning, and was able to then trace them to hotels where they had stayed to find, you know, the sign-in logs that they had there, rental car companies that they stayed at, you know, credit card receipts that they strewed around. Some of them even used frequent flyer numbers, gave frequent flyer numbers when they checked in at their hotels or rented cars or something so they could get their miles. It was a ridiculously
That's kind of
sloppy.
A head slapper, actually. Just to.
It really is. It's stunning. And it appears to me that the people who did that were actually CIA contractors. Not all these people were CIA officers. I don't think the CIA was collecting the miles, but evidently the contractors thought that if Abu Omar was getting a free flight out of this, perhaps they should too. So Spataro gathers all this evidence. It's against 26, eventually, of the kidnappers, alleged kidnappers, that he identifies, and he takes it to trial. In 2007, the trial began. Italy, doing things in Italian fashion, dragged the trial out till 2009. The entire time, the government's first of Silvio Berlusconi, the clown in chief over there, who's a right-winger, then in the middle of this, a government of Romano Prodi, who's a center leftist, and then again Berlusconi now, all of the presidents, just like we see here with Bush and Obama, that's about the same, opposed the trial, raised all kinds of motions, claiming again, just as Obama and Bush have here, that we can't try these things in public. To do so reveals state secrets, puts us in danger from terrorists, and so on. They were mostly unsuccessful. And after 2 years of trial, Spataro managed in winning convictions for 23 of these 26 kidnappers, and they have been sentenced to anywhere from 5 to 8 years in prison. And although most of them were convicted under aliases that they used while they were in Italy and therefore aren't in a huge amount of danger, if any of them sets foot in any country of the European Union and is identified, because the verdicts are good all over the European Union, they are to be arrested and forwarded to Italy to serve their imprisonment.
At this point, how do you feel U.S.-Italian relations are? You mentioned that certainly they were strained as the facts of the case came to light. How are things at this point?
Well, on the macro level, up between the White House and Palazzo Chigi, the White House in Rome, essentially. You know, those relations are fine. They were never hurt. You know, the White House pressured Berlusconi and so on to challenge the case. They didn't have to pressure. Berlusconi was one of the biggest, quickest, bootlicking supporters of Bush's war on terror and so on all over the world. So, you know, they did everything that Bush and now Obama could have wanted. So those relations aren't bad. The relationships between the CIA and the counterterror police in Milan were bad. They were completely appalled, disgusted, offended in Milan, the counterterror police were. And there was a period of really rocky, you know, just an abrupt breach in their relationship. And that, I have no doubt, hindered the efforts of both the CIA and the counterterror police of Milan in tracking terrorists. Now, I have been told by people in the magistracy and the police of Milan that that is over with, that they have gone back to a normal sharing relationship, and there's a lot of, for the most part, trust on both sides. On the other hand, it's going to have to be, it will always be, in the back of the minds of these guys in the counterterror police of what happened to them and whether they might ought to withhold some information. And I just got to think that somewhere along the line, that may hurt us. And not just in Milan. You know, the police all right. over Europe.
I was going to say, isn't that probably true throughout the world at this particular point?
You know, not everywhere in the world. There are, you know, places where you know, people are going to work with us. People are going to approve of what we did in Milan. They're not going to care if someone gets double-crossed. But in general, yes, I think that probably is the case, that people are, you know, in the back of their minds, if not in the front, thinking, might I need to not share some stuff with our American friends? And, you know, we'll probably never know. But if that ends up leading to a terrorist attack, it would again be another example of how our conducting of the war on terror has in fact made us less safe from terrorists.
And just to clarify, the 23 verdicts of guilty came back, but at this point no CIA arrests since they were tried in absentia and are apparently not being found on European soil at this point.
Right. And, you know, the Italians, the prosecutors in Italy have almost complete independence. They're like our federal judges here. They're appointed for life terms, and the prime minister can't kick them out the way President Obama could kick out a U.S. attorney who brought a troublesome case here in the U.S. But one thing that is a problem is, you know, Spataro got his convictions. He forwarded these convictions to the foreign minister in Italy and the justice minister and said, you need to forward these to the United States and request extradition. One of the things that the governments of the various governments of Italy have been unanimous about and bootlicking to Bush and Obama about is they have simply refused to forward these requests for extradition. So there will be no danger whatsoever of these people in the U.S. being extradited. Now, of course, even if those were forwarded to the White House has made clear, both White Houses have made clear, they're not going to send these, to extradite their criminals.
The Wall Street Journal called the Spataro, this chief prosecutor, a rogue. Isn't that interesting that it was like the folks that were, anything happened in Abu Ghraib, they were rogues. Anything happens that is out of, not in our liking, in the State Department's liking, are rogues. Something like, you know, Julian Assange, or we could go on and on, couldn't we?
Yes, indeed. You know, the Wall Street Journal, the Wall Street Journal is a very law and order, tough on crime when it comes to welfare mothers who perhaps cheat or to people who smoke pot. When it comes to you know, a prosecutor in Italy upholding the rule of law, you know, Spataro said, look, this is not a political prosecution against the U.S., though, of course, I'm aware of the great political implications. It's a kidnapping. Someone committed a kidnapping, which is against the law here on our soil. I can guarantee you, if Italian agents had gone to America and kidnapped a valuable person who the American police were looking into, we'd have a prosecution over there, too. Aside from that, if just Joe goes out and kidnaps Sally, there's going to be a prosecution if the evidence is there. The Wall Street Journal, it was really pot calling the kettle black. They have supported the rogue affairs of the Bush and Obama administration straight down the line. And what they're really offended by is that the principles of equality before the law were applied to our rogueness.
Yeah, you know, that's a little off topic, but it's very much in the news now about Julian Assange and then WikiLeaks. But for me, it's that they're trying to get him, I find really interesting, and that he would be responsible for something someone else leaked when he's an editor. Do you have any comment about that?
Certainly, just from a theoretical legal point of view, it's an interesting question. You know, is a person who, you know, the person who leaked the cables, or people who leaked the cables, clearly broke the law. Now, I happen to think that they should have, and it was a fantastic thing. But you know, that's not any, there's no legal doubt as to whether they broke the law. Assange, you know, by reproducing what was sent to him, I think has a very strong First Amendment argument to his right to do so. There's, of course, a counter argument for it. And how this will be played out is going to be fascinating. I think one of the more disturbing aspects of it is less the law itself and whether he'll be caught and prosecuted and all this other stuff than the almost implicit censorship that the condemnation of various senators and the Obama administration and so on bringing to WikiLeaks. So we've had stories in the last few days, for example, that one of his servers that the site is on refused to keep him. He then went to Amazon, put it on their server. Amazon gets a call from Senator Joe Lieberman.
No, that was. Lo it would be
behold,
funny if it wasn't tragic.
Amazon drops him. You know, so the greater, in some ways, perhaps the greater threat to whistleblowing, to the public's right to know about the wrongdoing of its government, may well be that that corporate censorship, even more, you know, it, which is not simply in a vacuum. That's, of course, happening in part because of the law against releasing some of this info. But it's interesting that Assange might not even have broken the law and yet still can't get his word out because there's no server, perhaps, that will take him.
And just another moment on that, and the censorship and sort of chilling environment this is creating. The memos issued by a college, I'm trying to remember, Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, as well as one issued by the State Department, warning people not to go to WikiLeaks. The Columbia University School of International Public Affairs document actually recommends that you do not post links to those documents nor make comments on social media sites such as Facebook or through Twitter, and that, and I'm quoting from this memo, engaging in these activities would call into question your, this is the young student's, ability to deal with confidential information, which is part of most positions with the federal government. So it's a, you know, not really thinly veiled warning that if you do this, you're not going to get a job with the State Department, which is, of course, why you're going to Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs in the first place.
It's really pathetic, isn't it?
It's really something.
I was reading an article not too long ago online that was written by one of the people, one of the professors in the 1950s, who was essentially run out of the country during the McCarthy hearings, not because he had done anything wrong, but because he had espoused radical leftist views. You know, once upon a time, there were at least a core of universities who fought for him and valued academic freedom. That's really disappeared. There's so little of that anymore in academia, which used to be a bulwark for these kinds of freedoms. I was speaking out in Colorado last month, and I ran into someone who was a professor at University of Denver in their international political program. And he was telling me that every, you know, I don't remember how often it was, but it was like every other week or so, he had a student coming to him asking him for a letter of recommendation to work in the CIA. Now, these are, you know, not extremely liberal departments, but once upon a time, you would have hoped that most kids who were going into these kind of degree programs, maybe they'd go to work for the State Department. You know, maybe they would do better things, you know, working for improving foreign aid and so on to countries that need it. But that a large mass of people were going to get these degrees in order to qualify to go work for the CIA and other such places, it's just distressing and depressing to me.
And myself as well. We have a couple of listeners who've joined us at this point. Good morning, Robert.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Doing all right.
I noticed there haven't been a lot of callers, and I got to say myself, I hesitated before calling in. This is a dangerous topic we're talking about today. Realize that the lawlessness, laws only apply to me and you, okay? Laws do not apply against anyone that prosecutors are not willing to prosecute. We have a hedge fund manager that runs a man over in Colorado, runs him over. This doctor is riding his bicycle. He's run over, left to die on the side of the road, hit and run. Okay, they catch the guy because he went to go get his Mercedes-Benz fixed. They catch him. The guy he ran over has traumatic brain, you know, has brain injuries, spinal cord injuries, all kinds of stuff. The prosecutor in Denver says he's not going to prosecute him for felonies, for the hit-and-run felony that he committed, because it might affect his job as a billion-dollar hedge fund manager.
So you're pointing out the...
I'm pointing out that we're focusing on little tiny...
Yeah.
Little tiny aspects of an entirely corrupt system. We can point to the foibles of Barack Obama or George Bush or Ronald Reagan, or you can just keep going.
But it's the system that, in fact, holds one class or grouping above the law.
You nailed it. That's the entire thing I wanted to share with
Thanks
you.
Very much for your call this
Thank
morning,
you,
Robert.
You have a great day.
We also have a call from Ron. Good morning. You're on the air. Good morning, Ron.
Ron, you want to turn your radio down.
We're going to have to turn Ron down for a moment. We'll check back in with him. We have just a few minutes left. And there was a question that came in on my instant messenger moments ago, which is, what is preventing the CIA from carrying out snatchings, kidnappings on U.S. soil?
It's a good question. You know, it's a far more controversial thing for them to do. When, you know, there aren't many repercussions the CIA still feels from the revelations of the 1970s around the Watergate period, that they had helped with Watergate and then spied on thousands of Americans domestically, which is banned by U.S. law. The CIA's charter is only to do stuff overseas, almost exclusively, two few tiny exceptions. But anyway, to cut to the chase, to break that law is still something that is not quite sacrosanct in the CIA, but is something that is very close to that. They do not want to do that. They know that while we don't care about rendering, most Americans don't care about rendering folks abroad, they would very much care about doing something like that in the U.S. And the second piece of that, briefly, is that they don't need to.
I was going to say, isn't that the FBI's job?
That was my cynical side, too. Yeah, okay.
The FBI's on top of it. The National Security Agency is tapping our phones. Our local police are, you know, looking over our
shoulders. We're
covered. They don't have to.
We're covered here. Yeah, we're fine.
And so, of course, that leads me to, what can we, as citizens in the belly of the beast, under the surveillance, you know, with the chilling effects that our caller Robert pointed out, you know, people nervous to talk about these things often as not. What do we do? How do we gain control, you know, from the secret security forces?
It's just a small question, Steve. Just a small question.
Just to wrap things up here in the last.
Yeah, you know, it's just so, I hate to say it, I hate to be a downer. It's so depressing how little power we have currently. And it's a longer project, right? You can't just, you know, writing letters to your congresspeople is important, of course. Mobilizing, having rallies, all that stuff, that is important. But what we need is a much longer step of building a broader movement that puts more candidates into office and makes them viable by taking back more of the media attention from the likes of Fox News and so on. It's doing all those things to build a movement where you get you know, you're not just aiming for someone who will stop extraordinary renditions. You're aiming for someone who understands that whole, you know, nexus of what I think of as leftist values, of American values. And it's just, you know, at this point, it's just inches forward and a foot back, and that's the way it's going to be for a while. I would add really briefly that people don't really need to be afraid about talking about this. Part of this sad, depressing thing is, you know, I get asked all the time, were you worried about working on this, the CIA coming after you? You know, we're just such gnats and fleas to them. If my book wins the Pulitzer Prize, they're going to respond. But otherwise, it's just one more little nick. Now, it's the 1,000 nicks or the 10,000 nicks that add up that will bring down these people. But at the moment, you know, we don't matter enough to them for them to bother with trying to do something about us.
I have to say, again, I couldn't agree more. And silence never protects us. I'll just point that out. History shows again and again, silence, it doesn't work.
Mm-mm.
Steve Hendricks, thank you very much for joining us this morning on Positively Revolting on KBOO Community Radio. Your book, A Kidnapping in Milan, The CIA on Trial, is available now, recently put out by Norton Press. Again, thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Great. Keep up the good work.